returning to our original music can only mean one thing. It's time for Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast which gives you, the listener at home, a taste of Thomas Tickler. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
And I'm perplexed.
And welcome to the first episode of Flight Through Entirety, covering season four of Doctor Who. Very important season. Of course, we say goodbye to the first Doctor and hello to the second Doctor, Patrick Troughton. I'm going to start the clock on our first story of season four, The Smugglers.
This is Dead Man's Secret Key. Norwood. Ring. Good.
Well, I think we're done.
I believe this is my story, Nathan. But yeah, there's not a lot to it aside from RRR and yeah,
and Curse of the Black Spot.
There we go. Now, I mean, we have an interesting position here. Doctor Who is in a position of transition once again. We have another new producer in the form of Innes Lloyd.
Hmm.
And, you know, Innes had sort of put his stamp on, with the Savages and the War Machines. I think it's less successful here, really. We have a historical based around Cornwall and pirates and smugglers, but it's you know what, this was my one, and I've watched the recon, and I've read the novel, and it just leaves you with an immense sense of meh.
It is. Oh, did you listen to the audio, though, the BBC audio?
Well, I did that when I was listening, watching the recon. It's not... I'm not saying... That's the thing. It's not bad, but what good there is just sort of outweighed by sort of feeling it's very tired. It's hardly a surprise that Innes Lloyd decided to drop the historicals just a few stories later.
I think it is bad. Really? And I think it's rightly forgotten.
I really quite like it.
We've got the good, the bad, and the middle.
So, again, we've talked endlessly about historicals, and there are two kinds of modes of historicals which have been identified as this Sandifer. I have to channel Sandifer once an episode. But there's the Lucarotti style historical, like the Aztecs or Marco Polo, where the history is kind of, or the massacre, I think, probably is you know, the quintessential one, where we're in a dangerous period of history, we can't really affect it, and we just need to escape, and history is a sort of scary, hostile place. And then we get the Donald Cotton version, the Dennis Spooner version, where
so nice.
We drop the characters into a story with strong genre tropes and let them have fun. And so presumably this is the pirate story, in the same way that the Curse of the Black Spot in series 6, I want to say, is the pirate story. Like, I don't know whether it's because I'm not so familiar with the source material and that, you know, there are definite sort of antecedents in literature and things, but I just sort of found it, you know, really a bit boring. We have the prison and we have the tavern, as usual, the pub and the prison in quick succession. So everything that we need from a 60s historical. But there's just, you know, really very little to say. I think production-wise, the fun thing about it is it's a season opener. We've got a new set of companions who we obviously, you know, were introduced to at the end of last year in what will become a tradition. You know, the new companion will be introduced in the final story. So we start with these. It's their first trip in the TARDIS. Mm. They're really sort of fun and interesting. Richard, you've said before how much fun you think it would have been to have these two young people kind of look after Billy as the Doctor for a whole year. That would have been sort of quite an interesting sort of idea.
A kind of Richard Lester. You've also already mentioned The Knack and How to Get It, or one of the Beatles films. It's, yeah, you've got Maud London jumping right in with, what was the Subotsky film that they made before Doctor Who and the Daleks? It's Trad Dad. It's that kind of thing. I'll be old and new. And I think if Billy had been more well and better, just cared for by the producers, we've seen how sensitive Bill is in other moments, and we'll probably allude to that fabulous, just recently discovered moment of an interview on the 10th Planet DVD that we all just watched before recording this, where Billy does Wow, talk about heartfelt truth. I really get the sensitivity and candor of this man and how much he cared about this program to the point, in fact, like you get a lot of really very sensitive people, that he excluded everyone who he identified as an enemy who didn't share the passion that he had. So instead of being able to maybe bring people in, he excluded and ostracized, and the more angry he became, the more he including, you know, as people like Annika Wills have said, you know, ostracize people on the set, which we'll get to in a moment. But this is really poignant for me, these last three stories. Is it three stories? Two stories, just two, sort of as three, because so much happens. Mm. Since we're on the smugglers, and you know, and again, you can look at, you see that Innes Lloyd's looked over the shoulder of Daphne Dare and said, which cozzies haven't we seen yet? We've got ancient Greeks and we've got Amerind. Oh, hello, pirates.
Mm.
But we've got, you know, antecedents are really big at the time. Disney's Pirates of the Caribbean, their first film version, had come out very recently and was a reasonable success. Peter Pan, which is a 50s cartoon from Disney, was still doing really well on the summer holiday circuit in cinemas.
Carry On Jack, thank you, that we mentioned last podcast.
Carry On Dick and Highwayman. And more importantly, Dr. Sin, S-Y-N, which was recently broadcast several times for BBC for Extra, the radio thing I keep going back to because I love it. And that's got Rufus Sewell in it as the eponymous hero, Dr. Sin. And it's almost this story. And that was a series of little books that were around at the time. Just kind of like post-Jack Harkness, Treasure Island, Robert Louis Stevenson kind of thing. The pirates were... It's something you should do in a historical, and we haven't got around to it yet. And I think it's a really jolly romp. And there's lots of R's and gnashings, and there's some truly horrible, horrible characters and some truly dark ones. Cherub is amazing. And what about the Squire? What a dreadful, dreadful, black-carded character.
I like him. That's the one thing that I like.
You see, that's the thing. I really like him, but I think he's the worst villain in the story.
Yeah, I think so too.
Cherub and Captain Pike, you expect them to be villainous because they're pirates, and they're doing the sort of RRR, whereas the Squire, he's insidious because he is only out for himself. And he flip-flops throughout the whole story to whatever side will give him the greatest advantage, and he gets away at the end.
No, you see, I don't read it that way. What I read it as is he's like he's a small-time smuggler. He's Paul Whitson Jones, by the way. He's the enormous sort of hilarious fat guy from The Mutants, the evil marshal of Solos from The Mutants. It's a really fun performance. He's really funny to watch. He's got a fabulous wig, you know, all of that. And I think that he's like a small-time criminal who then discovers what real evil bad guys are about and decides that he doesn't want any of that. And so he actually reforms. I think it's a little bit like the Algernon character in The Highlanders, which we'll talk about next time. He does have a little bit of a character arc, and so I think he's redeemed. I think he gets away with it because it's a redemption arc. I mean, it's not very strong. None of these things are particularly strong in the 60s.
I suppose it's hard to tell without the full visuals.
And can I just say that what we do have suggests that it would have been pretty impressive. So this is the first time...
Location looks great. Yeah.
So we go on location to Cornwall. It's the first time the cast have to stay in a hotel. Like, they're not driving distance from BBC Television Centre or wherever. Where are we? Lime Grove? God knows where we are. Where are we recording at the moment? Wherever we're recording. So they actually go and stay in a hotel in Cornwall. The beach scenes look fantastic. There is surviving footage of people riding horses around the place outdoors, which is really good. And this is another one of these really funny ones where a lot of the moving images in the recon are things that were cut out by the Australian censors.
Yes.
And so you just get moments of people being stabbed and then it's back to the slideshow. So it doesn't help that it's just a recon, that you're just watching a slideshow, but it is sort of largely pretty forgettable, I think.
What I find the most interesting thing about it is looking at the story from a production standpoint, because the actual story itself, You were talking about different types of historicals. I think this is a slightly different historical from what we've seen before. This is an historical adventure story.
Mm.
So it's the kind of adventure story in the style of, say, the last half of the Daleks, with a series of events that happen, which just happens to have an historical backdrop and historical characters. But what I find most interesting about it is it sidelines the Doctor in the same way he is sidelined in The Celestial Time Maker. He's locked up in a room with one of the villains and he even ends up playing games. You know, he ends up playing a game of cards. But the difference is it appears that Innes Lloyd or Brian Hales, who also wrote that story, it appears that someone had the sensitivity to say, we're not just going to shut William in a room and shut him up. We're going to put him in a room. We're going to take him away from the main plot, but he is going to have lots of the stuff he's good at. He's going to have rapport with the villain and be very intelligent and clever while we get Ben and Polly doing the other stuff. This feels like Innes Lloyd kind of going, I know I have to get rid of my star.
Mm.
I'm figuring out how to do it, but is there a way I can minimize his role? And I find that very, very interesting, and certainly Billy seems more comfortable here than he was towards the end of season 3. And this was made immediately afterwards. It was made immediately after the War Machines. The War Machines, you can see him getting his vigor back because it is a better script than the last few.
He's got stuff to do.
Yeah. Whereas, The Smugglers is kind of weird because it does sideline him, but at the same time, he gets lots of doctorish things to do while Ben and Polly are off doing the legwork. And Ben and Polly straight away are an excellent team.
Yeah, they are great, aren't they?
Yeah. And we've got this interesting inversion of Ian and Barbara, I think I mentioned it last month, where Polly is sort of, mind is wide open to accept anything, and Ben is completely, no, it is not that. It is not time travel. We're just down by the sea, and I've got to get back to my ship. Whereas, you know, Ian and Barbara were both a bit more open-minded, a little bit sceptical, a little bit open-minded, but Polly and Ben, they're just chalk and cheese.
Well, Stephen didn't believe. In fact, this is what this reminded me of, is you've got a historical and the Time Meddler goes out of its way to establish the new team, the new TARDIS team.
Mm.
And this does that as well by giving Ben and Polly a lot to do. And presumably they're aware at this point that Ben and Polly are going to have to carry the transition, so they need to be kind of strong characters whom we know. And so they are given a lot to do. They get to outwit Tom and get out of the obligatory historical prison that they're in.
And what I like about their outwitting of Tom, they outwit Tom using witchcraft. And I then expected that would be a cliffhanger that, oh, no, they're going to be burned at the stake. But no, it's completely forgotten because Tom thinks he's got a curse on him. He's not going to tell anyone he's got a curse on him. So I quite liked that subverted it. So maybe I like the story more than I thought. I don't know. There are certainly lots of good little moments in there.
It's a Brian Hales script, and he could almost, great lengths where he does no wrong. And don't forget the other shows he did in the 70s for children's TV, where he was just terrific, really, really good. The Robert Banks Stewart of his time. I really like this. There's some really lovely little moments in it. And again, Billy's stuff is good when he has one-on-ones with the... it's interesting when you go to the background of the story, it almost seems like Karma of the Actor, where, you know, there are lots of conflicting stories from Billy's own telling of where he was health-wise and place-wise and all the rest of it. But, you know, where it might have appeared that he was faking his illness in the previous season, Lloyd is now finding that he really isn't doing as well. And, you know, Billy later on said that he'd left because the show was becoming evil. That was actually the word he used. But then he also said that he'd had pleurisy and pneumonia, I'm just trying to say, and also a nervous breakdown at this time. Yeah. I don't really hear it in the performance, but...
Yeah, still.
I suppose the case is with a lot of actors who do have breakdowns or depression or what have you, that it's actually the acting, when they're acting, they're functioning well.
But, well, you know, it's after recording episode 2 that his wife Heather relates at conventions that was when he came home to Mayfield and told her that he was leaving the series.
Right. So is he told during the Smugglers?
Like, well, he told her that he was leaving the series not because of ill health, but just because he said the show had become too dark. There are many different versions from
That timing would make sense, though, because this was filmed at the end of the third production block.
Yeah, of course.
And then Tenth Planet was the first story of the new production block. So
and he's a guest star. He's not the star of the show. I mean, he's credited as Doctor Who at the head of it, but in the Tenth Planet, he's just a guest performer,
yeah,
as far as contracts are concerned. So they're just getting back for the first four episodes of Series 4.
Mm.
So, yeah, that does make sense.
Yeah.
Maybe he was told during the studio stuff. Mm. Someone at home will know. Someone will
write
tweet us. Or,
well, I mean, if we look at Adventure in Time and Space, that certainly seems to be the case. Mm.
It's funny you mentioned that, because this was about the time when, was it not, that Lloyd had commissioned Whittaker to write The Destiny of Doctor Who, which was about how to change over the role.
Mm. Arr. I've probably got even less to say, actually.
Derek Ware. Derek Ware is a Spaniard. We haven't mentioned him.
Well,
Mr. Havoc.
It's
as
the
a
first
Spaniard.
Terry Walsh, too, appearance.
Look, you know.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah, so, all right.
This one was possibly better than you remember, or not, but let's
have. I really like it only as an audio, not as a recon. Again, I just say, if there aren't a lot of images, the recons are really hard to sit through.
The pictures are great. It makes it look like the location stuff would have been really spectacular.
I like using. Just, I just like having it slightly in my head. It's like reading out loud, listening to the audio. It's, okay.
All right. On that note, moving on to the end of an era, the final William Hartnell story, spoiler alert, The Tenth Planet. Richard, this was yours.
It is. This is the, what Kenneth Williams have said, mid-70s radio, deviation of the universe. This is the one, the inversion. Everything's topsy-turvy, misrule. The January calends have been brought home and the universe has never be the same again. Other critics have said, you know, Sandifer, of course, we always go to our go-tos, Mr. Sandifer and Lawrence Miles and Mr. Tatwood, to both say everyone's got this wrong. This isn't
like
a regeneration story, and this isn't a Cyberman story because people didn't know what that was, and the Cybermen are never going to be the same in any way ever again. Just to jump in, I reckon this is the best Cyberman story. Because of what it suggests, not necessarily for what you're seeing on screen, but for the ideas. Although, can I say the scariest moment? I'm watching this with a friend who's now in his 50s, and we watched the first episode with that gorgeous moment of what looks like a human hand in a sleeve on the body. You pan up. That's a surgical GIMP mask with, get this, an actor in blackface behind it with white staring eyes and a helmet, utterly expressionless.
Yeah.
It's still one of the most frozen horror moments the series has ever done. It's truly scary even now. And what are these things? What are these things?
Yeah, the Cybermen just look fantastic, and it really is. They will just become robots by the next time they appear.
Mm.
And they'll be being groomed. It's the second monster ever to reappear, the second monster to make another appearance.
Those poor Vord.
Those poor Vord, they never worked again. And so they're being groomed, obviously, to replace the Daleks, which they will do, essentially, during seasons 5 and 6. There are no Daleks.
Because I think at this point the BBC were very much aware that Terry Nation was trying to launch his series in America, and they knew if that happened, they wouldn't be able to use the Daleks.
Yeah, so they turn the Cybermen into sort of fairly generic robots, and there are elements of them in the moon base when they come back. There are elements of this kind of Cyberman there, but this kind of Cyberman's never seen again. And for those of you who haven't seen it, I mean, it's remarkable. They have human hands. They don't have any gloves on. Their faces are just sort of cloth. And as Richard said, you can see the actor's eyes, but there's black makeup around the eyes, the mouth.
They open their gormless, silent mouths, and they don't move, but speech comes out. Mm. Peter Davison, when he was here in 83, just to age me, did a little convention here at Sydney Uni, and he said to us back then, were you at that one, Nathan?
Yeah.
Okay, you weren't,
no.
Brendan. And he said, the most scary moment for me growing up was that first episode, and the voices, and I still have memory of Peter Davison doing the voice, that sing song like this up Fender. And he liked that that was, he said, that's what computer synth voices were like in the 60s. And we went, oh, really? Did they? But yeah, he said, that's what we thought computer voices would sound like. Mm. And the synthesized thing of the robotic, not having pitch in your, but not having any meaning for the words.
Yeah. It's
really, really unsettling. And my go-to, just to jump in, if you want to know how good these Cybermen would be in the new series, have a listen to Nicholas Briggs' voices on Mark Platt's
Spare Parts. Finish.
Thank you, Spare Parts. Yes. Yeah. They're really scary.
And, but apparently, I mean, the story goes that Peter Davison and Sarah Sutton just roared with laughter when they first heard Nick Briggs do the voice.
Really?
Of Simon. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's apparently.
That's
it. Because, as you say, totally devoid of meaning.
You have to do the rest of this.
Judith Lucy?
They're never far away, are they? That's the little yellow character, the Busby little yellow character in Not Vision On. Anyway, that's the puppet voice. We'll look it up and put it on the rest of the thing. But there was a character on 70s British TV that actually had that voice.
Well, it's funny. It's funny Peter Davison saying that's what we imagine computers would sound like, because the other very famous verbal computer from that time was the Star Trek computer, which, of course, we now think of the Star Trek computer as Major Barrett's Next Generation.
Yeah.
Very gentle kind of voice like this. But in the 60s, it was Major doing a Dalek Cyberman voice, and it was very harsh and very high-pitched like the Cybermen.
But the Cybermen have this sort of strange thing where they don't have normal sort of intonation contours in their speech, and so it just sort of randomly goes up and down. And they also are sort of terribly polite, do you know what I mean? And they're much more eloquent. I mean, by the time of the invasion, I don't think the Cybermen even get a line in the invasion. I can't remember them saying anything at all. But these ones are quite chatty.
And look what they offer.
Yes, well, you see, that is the most terrifying thing.
It's looking even more pertinent now with the whole global warming talk and what's happening. They offer peace, security, and a passionless life without pain.
In fact, it's terrific. There's that scene, it must be in episode 2, where, because the Cybermen are only in episodes 2 and 4 as well. They appear at the end of episode 1. That's the cliffhanger, you know, what the hell are they? Then they're in it in episode 2, and they're dispatched at the end of episode 2. Then episode 3 is virtually free of Cybermen, and episode 4 has them back and a new set invade. And in episode 2, they're explaining that what they're going to do is save the human beings because Mondas is going to sap all of Earth's energy and they're all going to die. And so they're actually all trying to talk, and the Cybermen are going, you know, what's your age? You know, what's your name? All of that sort of thing. Like, they're collecting information to prepare them for the cyber conversion.
Facebook memes of the 60s.
Know your real name, because otherwise we can't cyber search.
But they're quite calmly talking in this fabulously dispassionate way about converting all of the people on the base. And it is something that you lose, like, you know, by the 70s. I mean, there's only one Cyberman story in the 70s,
yeah, exactly.
Revenge of the Cybermen. There's no mention of them turning people into Cybermen. That's
no,
not
indeed.
Even a thing.
The Doctor just refers to them being built of parts. You've got enough parts. You've got parts in your spaceship to build more Cybermen,
but he doesn't
refer to them converting humans. That comes back in force in the 80s, but yeah, it's kind of forgotten after this.
Well, even Earthshock, do people turn, you know, they're just sort of stupid robots in Earthshock with Darth Vader voices.
I think they do talk about turning Ridgeway into a Cyberman.
They do.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Terrible. But here, you know, I think they're really quite terrifying, and... And their origin is sort of mythic and really interesting. Like, they come from our twin planet that sort of wandered off into the universe and now it's come back. You know, and that's something that Russell captures in Rise of the Cybermen by making them be from a parallel universe rather than just a sort of twin planet to Earth. So they're us, you know, they're us in this
story. And they are in this story as well. They are humans. They're our lost primal people.
Mm.
I love Sandover's blog on this, and again, that's my go-to for this one. I won't go into it too much.
It's crazy.
But he's right.
It's really interesting.
The British fantasy and what we now call fandom and writing was very much on this post Aleister Crowley, darker, neo-pagan, Rider-Waite, tarot, stuff Annika Wills is into as well, that she references. The whole, you know, this is neo-sama of the burgeoning open mind thing you had at the beginning. Well, you know, there was the William Morris revival and the arts and crafts thing in the 60s. But along with that, from the time that was the whole lot of writing on, I guess, different kinds of enlightenment and approaches to enlightenment. There's one, and Sandoval mentions Kenneth Clark, who is a British writer. He died in 2011 and the inheritor of the Aleister Crowley Golden Dawn stuff. The necromancer, the Clive Barker stories use the same reference material. The idea basically is it's clipothic. Is the term?
Yes, no, I've never even attempted to pronounce that.
I'm sure I'm wrong. Enlightenment through darkness, we should explain. There's a lovely line where the Sidemen said, "We have gone, we have travelled the universe and come back. They have passed through the darkest." It's kind of the Hades. It's really a bit of seeing the underworld, isn't it? It's the, what's the character?
It's the everyone goes to the underworld at least once.
Yeah, Katerina.
Yeah.
The promised land.
Yeah. Oh, H.P. Lovecraft, Edgar Allan Poe, a lot of Lovecraft in this. Well, enlightenment is achievable through the passage of nightmares. Very Clive Barker. Now, I don't think that's actually a big leap, because once you read what Sandoval is saying and you're looking at this, yeah, that's what it is. They're us having gone through some horrible things. And they actually do offer a version of enlightenment.
Yeah.
But when Polly says, "But that's awful, letting death and things happen, that's not nice." She's the voice of sensibility and good sense and kindness as we see it. And then he looks at her and dispassionately and says, "You'll allow people to die in suffering around the world every single day. You do nothing about it."
Yeah, you don't care about them. And she loses that argument.
Yeah.
Completely does. Yeah. It's the biggest poke to how, you know, it's the first truly post-colonial moment in the show. Mm. When it says, you know, your society doesn't function.
And that's why the Cybermen are so successful in this, because they're not evil.
No.
They're
alternative.
They're alternative. They are ultimate pragmatists.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, later on the Cybermen would just become evil. You know, the wheel in space, they're attacking the space station with asteroids so they can get Earth's mineral wealth. Well, just land somewhere and get Earth's mineral wealth, which is what the Cybermen now would do. They just land and say, "We are taking this gold, thank you."
No one says delete in this. They're not going to kill people. They're going to better them.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah,
Horrible, cold to us way of possibly imagine. It really only achieves this again with Earthshock, doesn't it?
Mm.
Until the new series, when there's that nice line where Peter says, "You know, a lovely meal, fragrant posies, and getting your bum wet on the grass." That kind of thing.
Well prepared meal.
Yes, well prepared bum wetting on the grass. That kind of thing.
But when we do get those speeches, and it is a sort of an obligatory thing in a Sidemen story, where you talk about what they've given up by giving up their emotions.
They're some corners of the universe.
Well, the Cybermen lose that argument, do you know what I mean, in a sense, where here they win, you know, they're right.
Yeah.
And so I think they're sort of terrifying for that. And look, I mean, they degenerate into villains by the time of episode 4, you know, they're sort of fairly standard villains. Yeah,
they're taking the Doctor and Polly as prisoners because it's the Doctor and Polly.
Yeah. But I think there's a stack going on even apart from the Cybermen. Mm. So I read sort of Running Through Corridors account of this, and they talk about the fact that in episodes 2 and 4, you've got the emotionless Cybermen in charge of the base. And one thing we haven't mentioned is this is really the first base under siege story.
Yeah.
And that's a genre that's going to become exclusively the mode that Doctor Who operates in pretty much for the next few years. But then in episode 3, the peril is the over-emotional General Cutler, who's frightened for his son. And, you know, he's the one who hauls out the Z-bomb. He's the one who threatens life on Earth. He's the one who is going to kill the Cybermen.
Mm.
And so we do get to see, in a sense, that the Cybermen have a point about human emotions, that they're, you know, that they're dangerous and destructive and actually a real problem. Mm. And it's just demonstrated to you all throughout episode 3. And I think that's sort of terrifically good.
Mm. Another thing that's really great about this base is, and so soon after the questionable racial politics of season three, we have a multicultural cast in charge of the base, and a multicultural cast in the UN office. Now, we still have a problem in terms of sexual equality.
Like, yeah, there are no women.
There are no women on the military base. There are women in Wigner's office.
Yeah.
You know, they're still in a subservient position, but they're in an important position at the UN. But it is definitely worth noting that within a couple of months, it seems like Innes Lloyd has come in and maybe seen some of the quite horrible racial stuff that was in that season and went, no, I'm going to do better.
Well, we had Jamaica in The Smugglers, who's just another pirate. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
He's, you know, like,
there's
and
not
then,
much, you know, his race is mentioned as it would have been at that time.
But
yeah, he's, unlike, say, the Monoids, he's not regarded as stupid because he's black.
No. You know? And then you get this, you get the Australian and the American astronaut, in Zeus 4.
And what is it about Australian astronauts in British productions being a bit crap? I mean, look at Alan Carter in Space 1999.
He's great! Shut up!
He had two options in that first episode. Oh, the moon's flying away. Do I fly back to Earth, or do I go to the moon with my friends and possibly get killed? I'll go to the moon, idiot.
He got a year's work out of it.
A year and a bit.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, tangent.
And I think the other thing, too, that's overlooked is that Polly actually has a pretty significant role in this. And, you know, we do talk about the sort of lamentable sexual politics of the 60s, but Polly is the one who kind of, in episode three, she's really the one who starts the plan. You know, they're going to disobey Cutler. Cutler's going to blow up the Z-bomb.
Yeah,
you know, we've gone from the A-bomb to the H-bomb, but we're now in the near future. It's 1986.
A solar system level cataclysm.
We've gone through all of the letters of the alphabet as far as bombs are concerned, and we're up to the Z-bomb. And she's the one who really initiates the plan to kind of subvert Cutler's orders there.
But it does kind of come back to that thing I was talking about with the Peter Cushing films, which is it seems like you can only have one strong woman per script.
Or one woman, in fact, in this case.
Well, you know, as I say, there are, one sort of major character woman per script.
It's more antecedents. This is, again, closest to Kubrick than any other film I can think of. This is Strangelove, because Cutler is Jack D. Ripper, isn't he? Even with the overacting and the ham acting and that whole South Pacific, you know, oh boy, golly gee, and
that's his real accent, though.
There ain't nothing like a dame.
He is that really? Because he turns up in Blake 7 with that accent.
He does too, doesn't he? And I thought, again, he was just reprising the role.
He's Bran Foster with extra hair.
And extra roughage.
He's not actually that bad. He has some good moments, especially there's very few with Billy, aren't there? But there's this little...
We should talk about what happens to Hartnell. I've just read the novelization, which is called Doctor Who and the Tenth Planet, bizarrely enough. And it is by
Jerry Davis
who wrote the script. And in it, Hartnell does actually disappear in episode three, but not for all of it. So the story is that Hartnell is too sick to appear in episode three. We don't have episode four. So the last time we get to see William Hartnell as the Doctor until...
Regeneration.
Well, yeah. And until the Three Doctors, sadly, is episode two. And he's on the base. It's not really his thing. This does seem like he's a bit out of place here. There's lots of Americans and shouting and stuff.
But he still gives a really great performance,
deaf.
I think.
Yeah. It keeps being called pops and stuff.
But again, if you sort of look at the direction of it, a lot of time he's sat down, like they found him a nice comfy chair as soon as he walks in. But he commands the set from that chair. Like, he's a little bit modern Doctor Who in that he kind of listens to what's coming up and writes down what they're going to see before they see it because he knows.
It's very Matt, isn't it?
Yeah. Isn't it? Well, because that's the other thing, too. It's the first time in the near future. You know, like, it's set 30 years after the broadcast.
Well, 20 years.
It's set 20 years. So, you know, people watching it in 1966 could expect to be alive in 1986. The novelization sets it in 2000.
Just what I thought, yeah. The book was 86.
No, the book says 2000.
Okay.
And the novelization of Power of the Daleks, which picks up, sets it in 1996. Mm. You thought unit dating was bad, dear listener.
So the Doctor clearly knows the future history of Earth, and so he writes down that you're about to see a mysterious planet. And he seems to know, too, that he just says, I mean, they don't have to do anything to resolve the situation except wait and prevent Cutler from Zed-bombing everyone.
This is the first time we've had a future moment that's an intractable point, fixed point in time. Yeah. We've had the Aztecs, we've had the you cannot interfere with history. Finally, we've got a point, history occurs all over the...
You can't interfere in 1986. Because it's going to will have happened.
Yes.
So
with dramatic consequences,
with serious grammatical consequences. So and so he disappears for episode 3, and there's clearly lines that he should have in episode 3 been able to say, all we need to do is wait, and the Cybermen will overload themselves and Mondas will explode. And as usual, when Mondas explodes, all of the Cybermen will be dead. Just that. Tiresome, just because that helps us get out of the plot quicker. Stephen Moffat uses it in Deep Breath, doesn't he, where the half-faced man gets killed and all the other clockwork droids deactivate themselves conveniently so we don't have to go around and mop them up at the end. And he would have delivered that, but he's taking the... I just assumed he had a tantrum and didn't want to come in.
According to the various stories I've heard, including Annika Wills and production people and whatnot, he was actually taken ill shortly after the second episode filmed, or possibly during the filming of the second episode, and his doctor said he cannot come in. They kind of looked at the script where he wasn't really involved that much anyway. He's just saying, no, you just got to sit around and wait. So they just got Ben at one point to say, the doctor said, da-da-da-da.
You know. And then it's just some guy in a wig with his back to the camera plays the Doctor for that episode.
Is it Edmund Warwick again?
I wish it was.
I do hope it is, because Edmund Warwick deserves a send-off as well.
He does. and so we get the sort of resolution and stuff. I mean, the novelization kind of opens with the Doctor being weird and distracted and a little bit kind of tired and that kind of thing. But there actually isn't really that much... lead up to it at all. And it's almost as if the absence from episode 3 is a kind of inadvertently foreshadows what's going to happen.
Yes.
But in fact, it seems to happen for no reason and with very little fanfare. And I think that this is going to be a theme of our discussion, of the rest of this story, but also of Power of the Daleks, which is how little fanfare, how little preparation, how little apology there is for this giant, incredible move that they're about to take, which is to recast the leading man, which is just utterly weird and utterly unprecedented, I think. And they don't think they need to explain it. They don't think they need to lead up to it. They make it mysterious and off-putting. And if you compare it to the first regeneration that we see in the new series, where you've got Christopher Eccleston spending 2 or 3 minutes carefully explaining it to Billy Piper so that the audience at home aren't alienated from it, we get nothing like that at all here.
See, I do have a theory on that, which is, they'd been looking for a way to replace Billy for about 6 months.
Yeah.
And they've hit on this way, but nothing like this has ever been done on television before. Mm. I think they didn't highlight it because they thought, the more that we highlight it, the more obvious it will be.
Yeah.
If we make it as smooth as it possibly can be, we can't just put another guy in his wig, because they already discounted that. So we need to have a new person in there, but let's make it so that the audience have to figure it out at the same time as the characters, rather than having it fed to them.
Intelligent way of doing it. They chillax while keeping warm.
Yeah. Thank you, it's good, keep warm. I think the whole thing of not drawing attention to it is so that they don't have to explain it. And because they're kind of like, this is going to be jarring enough as it is, let's make it as smooth as possible.
Well, I mean, they don't have an explanation, and the idea that this is the first regeneration is completely wrong, because, I mean, the second time when he turns into Pertwitz, the Time Lords change his appearance. At no point do we get the word regeneration either
time. Yeah, exactly.
And so the regeneration's only really invented in the 1970s for Planet of the Spiders, so that's not what's happening.
Which is a Buddhist term that...
Yeah, that's why the term regeneration gets used. But, I mean, interpreting this in the light of future events, that's fine. It's a regeneration. You don't have to go all Doctor Who magazine and say, it's a rejuvenation and it's really just the same person. You know, that's kind of crazy in the light of what's happened since. But just the fact that they don't explain it, they don't lead up to it, and as we're going to see, they do nothing to kind of smooth the transition in the next story, I think is really remarkable.
Does anyone want to say a few words about the fact that we're now leaving Hartnell behind? How do we feel?
I have far too much to say on it, so just thank you, Billy.
He is wonderful. It is that thing, too, where when we were kids, he was the grumpy one. Do you know what I mean? We hadn't seen him. He was irascible and all that sort of
thing.
But
we knew him through the Target books.
Well, I never read the ones with Hartnell.
See, they were my favourites. Maybe that's why I just quietly say he's still my favourite Doctor.
And he's the only person to play the Doctor rather than a Doctor. Yeah. And he's just wonderful. He's so lovely. He's so terribly sweet. A friend of mine posted on Facebook, you know, he'd just seen the Five Doctors and was going, was Richard Herndl was the first Doctor really like that? He just seems horrible. I said, no, he's awfully sweet. He's cuddly and lovely and funny and, you know, terribly human and things. I think he's terrific. You know, it's been a great, you know, like a great 3 years for all the bitching that we've done about it. And he's just a great Doctor.
He's constantly surprising in a role that is, by its very nature, self-limiting and, you know, really auto-programmed. He's just there in the way that Cushing didn't really make it stretch any further. He had little moments that were terribly cool. Okay, he didn't have very long to do it. But in every scene, Billy will find something, a slight twist, slightly new way of doing it, something to surprise the viewer and keep us in there with him. There's lots of reasons I love him.
Mm. And what's really amazing about him is he has this mystique around him, even more so than Patrick Troughton, who was notoriously very private about how he played the role until later in his life when he was looking back on it.
Yeah.
Hartnell didn't get that later opportunity to talk about Doctor Who, and it's only recently that a TV interview has been unearthed after he finished the role. And we watched that before the podcast. And what's amazing about it is there's always been this debate in fandom about Hartnell, like, was he that forgetful, or were the hmms and the ahs and the hesitations, were their character? And you see this interview when, you know, his illness has really taken hold, according to the time frame, and he is focused, he is lucid, he is not hesitating in what he is saying, and he is completely different from his character as the Doctor. Mm. And
completely vulnerable.
In a way, that interview answers that question, but it throws up so many other questions about him as well. And I think that's a really good place to leave him, because he's the original and still the most mysterious.
Yeah, he is. God bless him.
Yeah, we love you, Billy. Thank you.
Out with the old and in with the new, it's time to welcome Patrick Troughton with Power of the Daleks. And this one was mine, and I've been saying for a few podcasts now that I've been looking forward to this one, because when Rod and I were making our way through and watching them, we really didn't think much of this one. But on my recent trip to the US, I hate watching videos on my iPhone, so I didn't take the recons on my phone. I took the John Peel novelization. Which, it's very, Richard's making a face. It's very interesting. For a start, it was towards the end of, actually, it was after, really, the Target novels. It was when Virgin had become fully established. So, the novelizations of Power of the Daleks and Evil of the Daleks are almost double length compared to Target novels. So, the first couple of chapters actually retells about the last 10 minutes of The Tenth Planet from, a second person point of view, with Ben as the second person. So it's not Ben saying, I did this, I did that, but it is like a narrator following Ben and telling us what Ben's thinking and what have you. It's Ben looking for the Doctor and Polly in the ship. Now, John Peel has long been regarded as a writer who does something called fan wank. Now, what that means is sort of just throwing in bits of continuity, and really this book is no exception, because after the strange old man and his two young friends disappear in the blue box, a team from UNIT turns up in the year 1996 to Snowcat Base to mop it up, led by Lieutenant Benton, Professor Allison Williams, and their UNIT's
official... spry, crotcheting, alert robot dog friend.
No, not quite. But he could have been there because they're accompanied by UNIT's official chronicler, Sarah Jane Smith.
Oh, please.
Now, the thing is, it's a bit like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, because after that, the book settles down and actually starts telling you things you need to know. And the book has given me a new appreciation of the story, because my big problem with the story before watching the reconstruction is I didn't understand why the rebels were rebelling. But reading the book and listening to the audio again just by itself helped me realise the sort of subtext and cleverness of the title, which I know you're going to touch on later, Nathan. But something in particular that I loved about it is because you've got two companions, one accepts him as the Doctor. Not straight away, but, you know, within a couple of scenes, because Polly just kind of goes, well, look, you know, he can't be anyone else. We saw the cloak go over the Doctor's face. It came off his face. He's the Doctor. Whereas Ben is like the viewer who doesn't immediately accept it. And we sort of have that again with the Peter Capaldi regeneration and first episode where he has to convince Clara and thus the audience. I think it's better handled here because you have the two perspectives.
Yeah, and they're presumably there. It's the same as the viewers at home. Like, for all we said about it not being explained, it is aggressively not explained.
Yes.
You know, like, the Doctor refuses to answer their questions. He's annoying on the recorder. He talks about Bill Hartnell in the third person. You know, the Doctor was a great collector, you know, all of this sort of thing. Like, he really is quite off-putting and, you know, deliberately goes out of his way to kind of put you offside.
Which makes him sinister. Because he's very, very friendly, but he's hiding something. And he's hiding what's happened to you know, everyone's granddad.
And then, of course, the first thing he does, he steps out onto the planet Vulcan, and he impersonates a dead man. He steps into his shoes and pretends to be that dead man.
Yeah.
So straight away, do you know what I mean? He's unreliable. He's impersonating someone who's died. And so they do deliberately try and put you off, I think, a little bit. I think the power of the Daleks is necessary, and I think the power of the Daleks is something brilliant that Whittaker does. And what's happened with the Daleks under Terry Nation is that we've started with the Daleks versus humans in a science fiction setting, and they're sort of, they're not humans as such, but they're sort of human-ish.
Humanoid.
And they're science fiction humans, you know, they're stupid. And then you've got the Daleks invading Earth, and then you've got the Daleks chasing the Doctor through time and threatening to become the star of the program, and then you've got the Daleks going to destroy the galaxy, do you know what I mean? And each time it's got bigger scale and higher concept and all that sort of thing. And what Whittaker does here is he takes it right back to the beginning. So we're in a city, it's somewhere in the future, but we don't know when, you know, despite what John Peel might say, he probably gives, you know, their address and their geolocation and the year.
Surprisingly, he didn't.
Okay, so it's very deliberately kept vague. And we have humans versus Daleks, but this time they're not stupid science fiction humans with holes in their clothes or lots of makeup.
They're real characters.
They're real people.
Thank you, David Whittaker.
Yeah, with politics and all of that sort of thing.
The B story is even more interesting to me than the A story. The politics of the colony are really, really great.
And the great thing about it is that the politics of the colony play out against this backdrop of the fact that we know that the Daleks are going to come to life and kill everyone.
Yeah,
and
attention.
We're waiting for it. And he will do it again. And I think he does it vastly less successfully in Evil of the Daleks, which I think wears out its welcome in a way before you get to
it. Might actually be going to agree.
Please keep listening, dear listener.
but in Power of the Daleks, it benefits enormously, and particularly because you get the Daleks being friendly. And you can see why Gatiss went back to this for Victory of the Daleks, where you have Daleks carrying trays and bringing people liquid and, like, expressing concern that the governor hasn't finished his liquid and stuff. Yes. It doesn't quite reach the superb heights of the Dalek going, you know, would you care for some tea? Which I just think is truly splendid.
And that's actually how Rod offers to make me tea. He loves that episode.
Yeah. So, you know, the fact that you've got these Daleks that you know, and, you know, you see the Daleks looking at the doctor. This is the first time you get Dalek eye view through a toilet roll, you know, and you see them looking at the Doctor and you see that they recognise the Doctor. And so they're sinister and malevolent all the way through, and you know that this rebellion is really not going to be permitted to reach its natural conclusion. And I think it works very, very well.
And it's all the levels, which I didn't pick up when I first watched the recon. And I think that's why I didn't enjoy it. It's all the levels on which the word power is used.
Yes.
There's actual electrical power. There is political power. There is the power of ideas and dissent. There is the power of identity with the Doctor not quite saying he's the Doctor. And as you say, also stepping into a dead man's shoes for the second time in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
There is the multiple power struggles with the humans. The novelization really fleshes out the character of Janley. You know, almost once a season in Doctor Who, we have had a female villain. We had Carla.
Wonderful.
Marga, you know.
Yes. If they don't end in an A, they're probably safe.
And now we've got Janley.
Oh, there you go. Like Missy.
Yeah.
It's not a vowel, but it still sounds like one.
And, I mean, something that John Peel doesn't shy away from, and I know this is kind of my drum that I beat in podcasts, he doesn't shy away from the notion of sexual politics.
Mm.
And the notion...
Well, neither does Whittaker.
That, yeah, the notion that Janley would perhaps be taken slightly more seriously if she wasn't a pretty girl.
Oh, I think she's actually more interesting because of that. Because she's able to subvert. Wouldn't this have been great if Whittaker had novelised this one?
Yeah.
This is my favourite Dalek story.
But here's a bit of an insight into John Peel's version of Janley's mind. This is after she's demonstrated the Dalek gun to the rebels, and they're all really happy. And the thing is, in John Peel's mind, she's helping the rebels. Not overly because she's interested in overthrowing the colony, but just because it will improve her position in the colony. Yeah. Fool, she thought. So easily manipulated by stupid phrases and idiotic desires. Soon there will be change, all right, but there will be precious little freedom for you idiots.
It's subtle, isn't it? It's a subtle narrative voice, John Peel's.
But the thing is, that is so politically relevant, because that is what bad leaders do and think of their people. Not that I'm pointing any fingers at a certain Prime Minister of Australia right now. Indeed. I'm not crediting him with as much intelligence. But I now adore this story. I've gone from thinking the story is meh to thinking that, God, this is so clever.
See, I don't read Janley as the villain in the same way that Bragan is. Like, I think Bragan is definitely a villain, and he's played by... Scarman, you know, the evil possessed in the future, and
Bernard Archer.
It's a terrific performance. He's terrifically good. But I think the fun thing about it is that the Daleks actually just end up being a kind of metaphor for the evil. You know, the Daleks are going to be used by one or either side, the rebels or the government, in order to prosecute a conflict that they're just having on a purely human level. Mm. And so the reason the Daleks are unleashed is because of this, you know, human inability to get on and a human inability to cooperate and human rivalries and human political intrigue. And it unleashes this force, this ontological force, if you will, that just comes in and mows them all down. And so the Daleks get an allegorical role. They get to play the role of human evil. And so they're unleashed and they reify that human evil. And those scenes are just fantastic. They just literally go through the base and sort of kill everyone off. It's spectacular.
Yeah, in a way that Mondas never could.
No. And And then there's the stuff about power. So the whole thing, the Daleks get, when the Daleks become a real threat, what it is they're going to become independent from the colony's power supply, and they're going to have their own power supply. And David Whittaker even brings back the idea of static electricity from the Daleks, that they operate on a different kind of power from human power. So they're initially dependent on the colony's power, but once they get unleashed, once they get to be a real force, they become independent of the human power structure and end up being having a power structure of their own. And the way that the Doctor destroys them is, before that can happen, he destroys the colony's power structure. And he even says, we'd better leave now. He destroys their power system, you know, their power system. And
on this alien planet with a poisonous atmosphere.
And he leaves before they can send him the bill, is what he says. And so there is that meaning.
Before Jacqueline Pierce turns up. You're really just waiting for the last scene, aren't you?
Yeah, she strides
takes over the colony.
Some dead bodies.
I'm Commissioner Jan.
So all of that double meaning of the word power and things, it is just terribly, terribly clever. Massively interesting. There's great visuals, you know, that inside the Dalek capsule where there's the incredible conveyor belt of the blob Daleks being put into the thing. There's huge scenes of Daleks. About half of them are cardboard cutouts, you know. there's sort of a number of Daleks and things. The Daleks are clever, you know, they're subtle. You know, they're vastly better than I think they've ever been. And I'd have to agree with you. I think it's the best Dalek story.
They show that they're the master of the universe, not through brute force, but through cunning and subterfuge and guile. They're smarter than us, and it's not nice to watch. Yeah. It's not easy.
And well, the reason they're smarter than us is because of our own petty rivalries. It's a bit like the Cybermen are better than us because they don't have emotions, and our emotions will literally blow us up with a giant bomb. The Daleks are better than us because they all work towards the same goal, whereas we fracture and splinter.
Yep. Does the Dalek actually ask Bragan why human beings kill one another?
Yes. And Bragan pretty much says so. Go away, I'm too busy to talk to you right now. And the Dalek was just like,
Thanks for bringing that up, because that's my perfect moment in this story. And you get the real moral imperative. Oh, once again, you don't have the upper hand, human.
Yeah.
You really don't.
Yeah. No, the Daleks aren't evil in opposition to the humans. The Daleks are a representation of the evil.
They're an id force. They're a force of nature. They're just a force, not necessarily.
Yeah, that's right. They're a psychological force or something. Yeah. It is so much smarter than the stupid Thals versus the Daleks, you know, the good and evil people and stuff. It's
another moment where we've seen before with Spooner, where Terry Nation's ideas are really great, as you can see, as a device and as a place to start with. Just don't let him finish the script. Somebody else jump in, please.
It's all right. He almost never does.
It's true.
We haven't really addressed the new guy and what he's like. So Troughton in this, well, he's literally on his feet from the first few seconds. It's not what we may expect from later regeneration stories where the Doctor spends a little time lying around or recovering or what have you, which, you know, would be an understandable thing to do. They've got to just get him up and get him straight into the story.
Well, he spends the first part of the story, the first few episodes, referring to Billy's Doctor as the real Doctor. What would the Doctor do? The Doctor, you're not really meant to believe it. The tension is kept going.
Yeah.
He doesn't, I don't reckon personally, he doesn't become the Doctor until the Lesterton scene, when he has that one-on-one with Lesterton.
Yeah, in all his early stuff, he plays it slightly differently in each scene, as if his character is trying out different personalities.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't know who he is yet.
Yeah.
He's a blank slate, so he tries being quite bullish at one point, and I think he's actually picked that up from Ben being very bullish with him. But yeah, as you say, it's when the Daleks show up and he starts confronting Lesterson that he kind of remembers.
And then the Dalek does that double take and looks at him in the eye stalk, sort of, and then you go, whoa.
You know, does it recognise him? And actually, by the end of it, we never get a definitive answer as to whether the Daleks recognise him as the Doctor.
I'm sure they do. I think
because I was sure that they would. But you know, Ben and Polly surmise that the Dalek looked at him, so he must be the Doctor.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's never explicitly stated, and I think that's very clever as well. It's a way to keep that kind of thing going, because, you know, a Dalek would start screaming, "It's the Doctor," like a broken Hitler doll.
Except that they're trying to be subtle, and the Daleks are being undercover at the moment.
Yeah.
I think that the huge, huge pity, and this is going to be a huge feature of Season 4, because it's the one that was most heavily... I don't want to say decimated, but I'll annoy pedants if I do. It was the most heavily affected by the junkings of episodes.
Mm.
There's not a single story that exists in its entirety, and heaps of them don't exist. And it's something like there's like a 12-episode run or something like that where the episodes don't exist from 10th Planet 3 to Underwater Menace 2. And so we don't get to see Troughton for a really, really long time. And we'll come next episode to Underwater Menace, and it's terrible. But the relief and actually seeing Troughton's performance in episode 2 for the first time, and he's magnetic even though the material's terrible, it just would have been quite spectacular to see him, because his Doctor, like, we can't see the performance, but we can see his Doctor, and his Doctor is vastly, vastly different. The closest that we've come to it before is the Savages, where he takes such delight in smashing up the machinery.
Real anarchic moment.
He is, you know, he's the most feared being in all the cosmos. You know, he drops out of the sky and tears down your world, you know. Mm. He's unpredictable. He smashes the place up. You know, he watches as everyone gets killed, but he destroys the Daleks, and then he's off before there's any, you know, explanation or apology or anything. He's really, really remarkable. He just smashes the place up and leaves.
And that becomes quite a thing for Patrick Troughton's Doctor, which we'll talk about more next episode. He does sort of, after whatever he's done, you know, regardless of any good or bad final consequence, obviously, there's always a good thing that's happened. He slips away quietly and unnoticed, more so than any other Doctor.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be quite interesting to look at as we go through his era.
But he's spectacular, and I think it does give the series a shot in the arm straight away. We'll see how it plays out.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not forget that we see the first shimmer of the Dark Doctor in this. Billy would never have sent a platoon of guards to their death. Listen, I don't believe he did. I don't remember a moment, do you?
No.
But Bragan's guards, that's what Pat does to sort it out. Know,
that's what they're for, send them there to divert the Daleks.
Soldiers, send them off to their doom. I don't like soldiers.
Yeah. Yeah, I was looking out for that because I'd heard of that, and I don't think he's as directly responsible as it seems, but he's remarkably unaffected by it. Do you know what I mean? He's kind of happy for it to happen.
Yeah,
so he does become this strange anarchic figure in a way that we haven't really seen very much of.
Right, on that note, I think it's time for us to move on. So we'll be back next week with a new episode, looking at the next three stories for Patrick Troughton, and yet another shake-up to the TARDIS crew in those three stories of the Highlanders, the Underwater Menace, and the Moon Base, where we also see the Cybermen come back again.
And I think we see Doctor Who reach its current form.
So I'm going to say good night.
Yeah, well, good night from me.
And good night from me.
Good night.
You have been listening to My Good and Piracy with Nathan Bottomley, Brandon Jones, and Richard Stone. This episode, Bomb Wedding, was recorded on Sunday the 4th of October. The next episode will be released on Sunday the 26th. You can find us at flytoentirety.com, flytoentirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FDE podcast on Twitter is a short way to being all over.
All right, on that note, moving on to the end of an era, the final William Hartnell story, spoiler alert, The Tenth Planet.
Woo-woo.